If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Michael Gargiulo stalked and slaughtered his female neighbors in LA in the 2000s until one survived.
She painted a picture that you could never imagine.
In a first on Mind of a Monster, we dive into a case that's still active. Did Michael's murderous rampage start in the 1990s when he was just 17?
His impulsivity and his rage was starting to peak around that age.
Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Hollywood Ripper, wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. An opportunity to get voted off the island and join the real party here with the rest of us. It's time to intervene on our own behalf. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Please subscribe, link, support, get the ad-free Team Human team feed, and access to our community. Just want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Everyone's Earth, maker of these brand new puppies, Kobe Laundry Buds. These are in place of detergent or in place of those little plastic pods. These are healthy, good for the world. They're just like pills. You chuck it in the washer, throw in the laundry, turn it on, and, you know, run a normal cycle with just this. No laundry detergent, no nothing else. No chemicals, no plastics, no bad. Just put this in and your clothes get clean. The world is saved. The babies can wear these clothes washed in this stuff and not get all irritated like they do from detergent. This stuff's great. And then when you're done with the bag, you just put it in the landfill. It's that good. All right. Kobe Laundry Buds. Go to KobeClean.com. Put in the discount code Team Human just from now to like March 15th. Put Team Human and you get 31% off. It's our big farewell to our loving sponsor of the year, Kobe Everything. So I got a text from my daughter last week asking, so why are you in the Epstein files? So cut to the chase. My name is in the CC field of emails from my former literary agent who used to publish a journal in which a bunch of scientists and thinkers like me would answer questions about the future, like what should we really be worried about, or what scientific concept would improve everyone's cognitive toolkit. And the agent would start by sending the question to a group of maybe 30 of us, people from Brian Eno and Cory Doctorow and me to Jared Diamond, Sam Harris, Jonathan Haidt, and also Marvin Minsky, Sergey Brin, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and right in there in the same CC section with the other 50 names, Jeffrey Epstein. Well, you get the idea. Well, maybe you really get the idea, right? It's not that we were supposed to reply all with our answers to the whole group. It's more that the CC field of big names, it was there to help us all know this was an impressive group of people with whom to be participating. It's that sense of reputational power and what we might compromise in order to get close to it that characterizes my own brief brush with this crowd. I told some of the story in my book, Survival of the Richest, but there was more context to it all that didn't really fit in that book, so let me share it here. What I'm hoping to show is that while there may be something truly evil in an Epstein or a Trump or a Ghislaine Maxwell, it may be too easy to simply alienate ourselves from them as if they were a different species. And certainly the hundreds of men and even a few women who partook of the rape, torture, and apparent killings in Epstein's world did not act like we would, but they may have been acting in ways that we could. And I'm thinking more along the lines of Hannah Arendt's book, The Banality of Evil, that great atrocities are not committed by fanatical monsters, but ordinary people conforming to a system. So she was referring to the unquestioning obedience to authority in Nazi Germany, like soldiers following orders. But there's another kind of obedience to a social order or to a permission structure that allows for people to do things that they know are wrong, but are still compelling on some other level. By calling Epstein and his conspirators purely evil, as if they were a different species of human altogether, we risk repressing the function of the inner voices and sensations in ourselves that keep us from surrendering to our own baser natures. So, with that said, here's my tale. I got invited to my first real New York scientist philosopher grown-ups dinner party in the mid-90s, right around the time my first books were coming out. I was the kid in the room, the newcomer, who happened to know about this new fad called the internet. I was both scared of these people and probably looking to challenge them a bit, get them to remember me. And I don't remember everyone who was there, but I distinctly remember Richard Dawkins sitting on a couch, guest of honor, folding one of those little origami fortune teller things and then holding it up and saying, "This is a meme." Yeah, duh. But it was early. He meant that the instructions for making one of these things get passed around like code, and then someone somewhere actually makes one. The people, he explained, are just the carriers for the meme. We execute its instructions like an organism following its genetic code or a computer running some lines of Python. And it didn't make sense to me. In my own book on viral media, it was based on very different observations about our relationship to memes. For me, memes were just the code within media viruses and better understood as hidden agendas in popular culture, right? The Rodney King tape may have contained powerful memes about police brutality and race relations, but the reason the tape became a phenomenon was our readiness as human beings. We had repressed this subject for too long, the police brutality, race relations, discrimination. So we were triggered into a national conversation and even riots, right, by the images that forced the issue into the light of day. The memes aren't running us like software runs a computer. We use the memes the same way we use language or our bodies to express ourselves and enact change. We are conscious actors, not passive machines running code. Team human, right? Well, Dawkins, he dismissed my argument as wishful thinking, and I was too insecure to press the point. I went over to the food area and took some Swedish meatballs, and they were good, expensive, catered food, right? But half an hour or so later, I hear some ruckus from over where Dawkins had been sitting. And Naomi Wolf, remember her? And at the time, this is when she was still a super respected feminist author of The Beauty Myth, and really one of the only women at the party who wasn't there as a plus one, right? She was refusing to submit to Dawkins' reductive picture of reality. I remember she said, like, "You mean there's absolutely nothing going on here?" She felt that his model of humans functioning like machines left no room for mystery, experience, will, not to mention the possibility of a soul or God. And Dawkins and the other name brand staunch materialist scientists, they were patronizing, even ridiculing her. "The universe is empirical. We are just clusters of organic matter responding to the illusion of consciousness. Any other frame of reference amounts to superstition or delusion," right? There's nothing out there or even in there. And I don't know whether I was trying to defend Naomi or make my own mark, but I took a shot. I suggested evolution isn't random selection, but maybe it's life reaching towards something, complexity, consciousness, compassion. We're not just driven by genes and natural selection. The earliest human beings, they shared with one another, even when there was no personal survival benefit. Dawkins and the others, they laughed at me. I was simply misinterpreting reciprocal altruism. And any empathy or urge to share is a stimulus generated by our DNA for its own selfish ends. Humans are just vehicles for our genes. Our genes are selfish, and we have no choice but to do as they say. I tried to argue that scientism, unlike science, was kind of like a religion of its own. Great for engineers, but we do not assign meaning to things based on evidence. It's a socially constructed system built over millennia. Only a community of people can ground objectivity into any real sense of purpose. Meaning is how we develop a sense of right and wrong. And Dawkins and his crew, they just rolled their eyes and laughed. And he called me a moralist. Like, that's a bad thing, a moralist. And I didn't see that crowd again for a few years. Maybe my agent knew better than to invite me to another gathering for a while. But he did. It was a super special elite dinner in New York City that would be attended not just by those superstar scientists, but by some big tech CEOs like Steve Case of America Online, Jeff Bezos of the Amazon bookstore, maybe Bill Gates, and so on. I wish I could remember which ones were there or I would tell you, but I was such a Gen Xer punk that I really didn't care, or at least I acted enough like I didn't care that I avoided their tables and now I've actually forgot. So he invited me to add a plus one, right? Which means that given the cost and exclusivity of the dinner, right, that means a lot. He was trusting me, I assumed, to bring someone worthy of this crowd of science and tech luminaries. So I invited the smartest, wittiest person I knew, the brilliant founder of an online literary culture zine. And the minute I got through the door, the host grabbed me by the wrist, pulled me aside, and he just tore into me. "How dare you waste your plus one on a lesbian?" Huh? Right, I was stunned. He said, "You're a young writer. You're supposed to raise the quotient in the room. Why do you think I gave you a plus one? Look around." And he motioned to some of the tables. There were young women sitting with middle-aged men. There were a few founders with equally beautiful, well-dressed wives. But I understood what he meant. I was an East Village 20-something and should bring a hot date to help decorate the party and increase its apparent value. Raise the quotient. I got really upset that night. I was ethical enough to know this whole scene was deeply fucked up, but young and insecure and ambitious enough to wonder, if I was the fucked up one, is this how guys are supposed to be? Is this why the girls in college seem to go out with assholes? Is there something evolutionary that I'm missing here? Don't worry, I didn't fall for any of it. But I did make sense of it pretty quickly. How the belief that there is nothing going on inside a human being makes it easier to commoditize women in this way, to measure a room of human attributes as a marketplace, and to assume an almost eugenic understanding of human value and relationships. It was these kinds of experiences that pivoted me from a tech writer to a humanist, looking at how we maintain values in a landscape increasingly dominated by code and men with these sick values. So, honestly, I wasn't surprised when, 15 or 20 years later, when I found out who had sponsored that online magazine where all of us scientists and philosophers were emailing our precious thoughts and punditry? Who had paid for that party I'd failed to decorate with the right arm candy? Jeffrey Epstein. Duh. The same Jeffrey Epstein who was funding the revival of eugenics and planned to seed hundreds of women with his own sperm. He had built dormitories for the purpose on his island. And now, photos were surfacing of Epstein and several of his young escorts together at a New York City party with tech millionaires and many of the very same scientists who were rejecting citizenship in a moral universe as laughably deluded. Yeah, you got that right. Another photo showed up on Twitter with Daniel Dennett, Steven Pinker, and Richard Dawkins himself flying to the TED conference on Epstein's Lolita Express. Now, sure, anyone can end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, but the scientists Epstein chose to hobnob with weren't selected at random. Their scientistic approach, interpreted through Epstein's sociopathic lens, it dovetailed perfectly with the values of domination and control. These are not thinking humans you're abusing. They're like vegetables. They use the same logic as slave owners or conquistadors. Those are objects. Might makes right, or the DNA made me do it. It's banality of evil on technoscientific steroids. I've traced this lineage of thought before. This is what we talk about here, the way that scientists and engineers made themselves so vulnerable to the logic of the dominator and to the abuse and subjugation of women. After all, the original premise of empirical science, as articulated by its forefather, Francis Bacon, was hardly value-free. It was based on the subordination of nature and women. As he explained to his 17th century moneyed benefactor, King James, nature would have to be forcibly penetrated to yield her secrets. "I will bind her to your service and make her your slave," he explained. "Nature must be taken by the forelock, lay hold of her and capture her, conquer her and subdue her, to shake her to her foundations. Subject nature to the same sorts of torture as women on trial for witchcraft." Right. Francis Bacon was to King James what MIT Media Lab scientists were to Jeffrey Epstein. "We will use scientific principles to support your domination of women and nature." Nature was scary, dark, female, a space of mystery. Empirical science could capture and tame this beastly force, quantifying its properties and rendering it safe and inert. Scientists even joined the witch-burning frenzy. Witches were better healers than bloodletting male surgeons. Killing them got rid of their greatest competition. And acknowledging the power of black magic, even though they didn't believe in it, got them on good terms with the church, which was worried about godless scientific materialism. Any of this sound recent as well? Right, these guys, they also internalized a chauvinism and a disregard for alternative and embodied approaches to making meaning that have since limited science to this day. Everything had to be measured in terms of mass or heat or some metric. The quantification of our world, it contained and controlled everything that mattered while ignoring the pesky, undefined aspects of reality that men of science didn't want to mess with, especially emotions, meaning, ethics, consent. Empirical science also, it conveniently separated causes from effects. Things acted upon each other, but were not understood to be in dynamic relationships. Something or someone was either a subject or an object, solute or solvent, predator or prey, man or woman, lord or peasant, master or slave. The further they could separate cause from effect, the less they had to look at what they were doing to whom, right? It was perfect for colonialism. Scientific engineers, they armed the gunships, they insulated the powerful from the impacts of their actions, and they rationalized an ethos of extraction. This is the legacy of domination and control characterizing too much of the science and technology industry to this day. And it's how you get a biologist as brilliant, as genius as Richard Dawkins, reducing the mysterious phenomenon of human consciousness to nothing more than a movie projected for us by our genes. Back at that party, Dawkins said he saw human beings as, I'm quoting here, survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. Dawkins' model of humans as hardware and the other anti-human ones of Daniel Dennett or Steven Pinker, they won out in Silicon Valley. Their views were entirely more compatible with business models that depended on manipulating human beings instead of empowering them, exploiting them for profit rather than giving them opportunities for collective creativity. If people were really just passively responding to lines of genetic or cultural code, then why not be the ones writing the code and capitalizing off of it? Jeffrey Epstein liked and funded these scientists because they helped him formulate a picture of the world that gives cover to those who would exploit other human beings. As they see it, people aren't really alive or aware. They're just behaving in service to their genetics. And if you play your cards right, in service to your genetics. Yeah, I'm talking to you, Elon. The Jeffrey Epstein saga has been as triggering for me as anyone. As a theater kid working with grown-ups in the 1970s, I had my fair share of unwanted touching and worse. And through those experiences, I learned what it feels like in your body when you're not giving consent. It's unique, it's different, and it stays with you. It's the uniquely human somatic sensibility that something is wrong here. It's the feeling I had watching Naomi get ridiculed, just one notch too sadistically by those scientists. It's the feeling I had at the Epstein-funded dinner party when I was told I had brought the wrong kind of plus one. I never actually met the man. I didn't know who he was or that he'd funded that dinner. This was in the mid-90s, before he was famous or had an island or anything. But I could feel what it would mean to submit to the energy of that party he paid for. Yes, this inner sense is spiritual. It's moral. It's a delusion, even. but it's one we depend on not to sink into sociopathic behavior. Even the word sociopath means socio disease or a disease of society. If there is no society, no collective meaning, if that's all delusion, then there's no disease. They don't get that feeling in their body. Or if they do, they learn to ignore it until it just goes away. Or they learn to come in over it, oomph, and convert the vulnerability into control or sadism. Since the Epstein revelations, I've tried to understand the men who did that stuff, who must have had the same spidey sense in their bellies, but then went for it. It's not that they're constitutionally more evil than the rest of us. I think Hannah Arendt is right, and that it's less a matter of having a truly sinister core than living within a power system or maybe a permission structure that invites people to succumb to their baser natures. Living in our world right now, it could happen to any of us. They know it's wrong, but it starts almost innocently. That young woman's interested in you. She's over 18 and interested in your ideas. Of course she finds you sexy. Ideas are sexy. Then it gets incrementally more absurd or perverse or illegal or sadistic from there. And any time you question what's happening, there are rich, important people, politicians, even scientists there telling you it's okay. We're not restricted by Puritan values here. The age of consent in Japan was only 13 until a year ago. Ancient Greeks, yada yada. This island is self-sovereign, so the laws don't. Oh, look, that's Alan Dershowitz over there. Prince Andrew over there. Even my pal Noam Chomsky says. Right, there's no forgiving. I'm not going there. These are creeps, rapists, and quite possibly murderers who, even more triggering to anyone who has been abused, are going to keep getting away with it while continuing to victimize their prey. In their view and that of the courts, the perpetrators are the victims whose names must be redacted from the files. What I'm concerned with, what I'm always concerned with, is the ground. The dehumanized, hyper-rationalist, sociopathic permission structure condoning the rape of 12-year-old girls is the same permission structure for people to be executed in the street. Authoritarian rule, desecration of the natural environment, genocide in Gaza, slavery in the Uyghur province. See, the rape, torture, and humiliation of young women at the hands of the oligarchic sociopaths impacts more than just their immediate victims. Those crimes are heinous enough in their own right, but the inability of their victims to win justice, the apparent ineffectuality of their testimony or the revelation of these crimes to accomplish anything, is a public demonstration of their power. It's meant to serve as evidence of the impotence of our collective will to act on the victims or our own behalf. It tells us that the feeling we have inside, the impulse in our bodies that knows right from wrong, is not worth feeling, hearing, or acting upon. That conscience or basic humanity is futile. The violence is their proof and celebration of a cruel, godless world of might makes right. Anything else is a delusion. And it all comes back to that argument I supposedly lost to Richard Dawkins about memes. It's not about the argument, the ideas, or even the memes. Hannah Arendt used to say that no political idea justifies violence. We could take that further. No idea is more important than the comportment or manner in which it is expressed or conveyed. Even if you're right, even if your idea can win, how are you going to use it? To humiliate a woman at a party? To earn the approval of cruel men, professional points from peers, or funding from a wealthy patron? Your memes don't matter. Your genes don't matter. Nobody cares except you. I promise. As a former insight junkie and current professor of media theory, I know the allure of a complex mental construction, from selfish genes to effective altruism. A good one can even get you laid, at least on the right island. As long as it's an idea that negates the essentially social, mutually negotiated, consent-bound dance of love to which we've all been invited. To join the dance, you don't need any idea at all. You don't need to overcome that warning from inside your belly, because it's not that kind of party. And it's not asking you to cut yourself off from your inner felt awareness of how consent, connection, and compassion really work. It's asking you to open up to it and let it lead. Because deep down there, way down, that's not you at all. That's Team Human. Thanks for being on Team Human. We're changing things up here, moving to a more listener-supported format. And while we'll be expecting more from our listeners in terms of subscriptions and support, we'll be offering a lot more back as well. Patrons will be invited to monthly live Zooms where we can talk about whatever matters in the moment and make sense together of how to respond. I'll also be answering supporters' questions on a monthly Ask Me Anything, where if I don't have the answer, at least I'll work through the problem out loud and try to validate where the question's coming from. You'll also get the ad-free version of the show and some other bonuses we're putting together. So please, if you're in a position to do so, go to teamhuman.fm and click on support, or patreon.com/teamhuman. And if you can't do that, please just click on subscribe or like or leave a review or tell your friends we're building a community of care and compassion to discuss dangerous ideas in the safety of solidarity and mutual support. Please join us on Team Human. Our last best hope for peeps. In case you missed it, we are sponsored by Everyone's Earth, maker of these Kobe Laundry Buds. It's a brand new product. These are good for the world laundry buds. No plastic, no polyvinyl, no horrible stuff. You put it in the washer instead of anything else. Just put this in and your laundry and wash them. This will totally dissolve and then go out into the Hudson or wherever your laundry water goes, and it won't kill the fish and do all that bad stuff. It's all good. All right. So get this, Kobe Laundry Buds. Go to KobeClean.com, put the code TEAMHUMAN in there, and you get 31% off your purchase. All right. So check it out, Kobe Laundry Buds. I actually use these. All right. Be good.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Christian Bale was preparing for his role in American Psycho, dressing the part, hitting the gym for the first time in his life, even getting his teeth redone. There was just one problem. He didn't actually have the part. Leonardo DiCaprio did. Listen to our podcast, What Went Wrong, every week as we unearth the chaos behind Hollywood's biggest movie flops and most shocking successes. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.